morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFV. And today's guest, I'm going to take off my Dr. Connor hat and introduce her as Michael and Julia, because Julia Fallon, like I said, is just an extraordinary educator, and also an extraordinary friend of mine. I absolutely love Julia. We are on, I like to say, this kind of group nerd text by way of Jacob Cantor. Thank you, Jacob, for putting all of us nerds together on this text. And you should see some of the messages that are going back and forth. Rob is like, Rob Dickinson, love you, Rob. Rob is designing something with AI. Julia is doing, writing another report. Saba is changing the world with AI. It's just an app, Sophia, who's a part of that. And we have just all became close when we see each other in person. Great conversation, share the platform. I learned from each and every one of them. And again, like I said, have become very, very extremely close friends in this network. So I want to introduce again my personal friend, one of the greatest educators, I think, in that subjectively and subjectively stated, Ms. Julia Fallon, who is currently right now the executive director of CETA. And then also she was the former program lead at the Washington Office of Superintendent of Public Education, changing the world with her work, working directly with CTOs and CIOs across the country. When I was at FETC, when Julia was like, hey, we have an invite only party, an event that, do you want to come? I felt special. I was like, okay, yeah, Julia, this is awesome. So without further ado, I want to introduce my personal friend, like I said, a great and extraordinary impactful educator within this ecosystem and really changed the dynamics of technology and artificial intelligence, which we're going to get into this episode, Miss Julia Fallon. Now, Julia, I know you paid me $1 million to say all that about you, so...
I wish I had the money to give you to say that, all that stuff. So thank you so much for that warm introduction. And I agree with you. Our group chat, I feel like it's a group of learners. We definitely, you could tell we are a group of learners, and we are sort of like, I'm blown away by what Rob Dickinson does with AI. Like, I'm literally like, I feel like I'm such a basic user compared to him, but I'm learning from everybody kind of what we're kind of in the space, right? It's just, and again, shout out to Jacob Cantor for kind of pulling us all together to have that happen. And it just organically has grown on its own.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and to my audience, you know, that right there, that text thread that we're in with Julia and Saba, Jacob, Rob and Sophia, literally to me, that's like 5 to 6 different podcast episodes unpacking each of their intellectual property and bringing Rob is at this another level. I can't wait to have him on VFE as well. But Julia, this is focused on you. And we've been trying to do this for months. I mean, literally for months. I mean, we were talking at FETC, at Topgolf. I'm like, yo, Julia, we swinging the nine iron. Julia, what's the date? Then, you know, changing with that. But so glad to have you on, specifically in the month of March, right? Definitely for my VFE viewers. This is going to be an extraordinary episode. But Julia, I want to highlight you and I want to highlight your work, but also I want to see what that association is with a song. So we all know, or to my audience, right? You're multi. Let me get this. I want to stress that, friend. Multinational award winner, former program lead, like I stated at the outset, at the Washington Office of Superintendent of Public Education, and now the Executive Director of CETA. What song describes your leadership signature in the ecosystem?
For those of you that don't know out there, I also moonlight as a DJ. I learned how to mix during the pandemic, and it's sort of taking on its own life and everything else. But there is a song that I will always pick, I think, as the one that describes me, but it's also my most favorite song, and it's been my ringtone since 1999. So for those of you that remember when we used to have to buy ringtones, I used to buy the ringtone. Don't have to do that anymore, thankfully. But I would say that it's probably, and if you're a house head, and if people understand what that is, and that is my audience, but if you're a house head out there, it's got to be The Music Sounds Better With You by Stardust. It's iconic. And even if you're probably not a house head, you probably have heard it somewhere on the radio waves. It's still going strong and everything else. But I think why it works for me, and to answer your question, is that leadership is sort of a collective rhythm, right? It's not a solo performance. I don't do this all by myself. I always give credit, especially in the position I'm in now, to my CETA community. I've been part of the community for 23 years, 17 and a half as a state member when I was representing Washington, and then 5 years now as the executive director. But it's a collective rhythm, right? We do it together. It's not all on just me. Even our group chat is a sort of a mini version of that kind of collective vision and rhythm and everything else. And for me, I'm very systems focused. So The Music Sounds Better With You is almost like when systems work, when people feel seen and connected and in sync. So I think sometimes about like systems and that song, like it's the music is better with somebody else, right? I can enjoy the music myself, but it's almost so fun to share it with folks and do that sort of thing. And in my role as a DJ, right, like I think about this song and everything else, I have to read the room. I have to adjust tempo, and I have to create conditions where other people get to shine. And that's really why I think it kind of describes the leadership too and everything else. And again, it's a very iconic song, and it just brings a lot of joy and happiness when I hear it.
First, Julia, I wanted you to bring up the DJ. I was going to keep it to a professional vertical, but yes, to my audience. What is it? Twitch, Julia?
It's Twitch. Yep, Twitch. Yeah. It's a live streaming platform.
Yeah, on Friday nights. And I remember Julia was like, hey, you know, come check it out. This is what I'm DJing. To my audience, yes, Julia is. I mean, I had me bumping my head like this, right, with Julia. So please check her out Friday nights on Twitch at the end of the episode. You'll be able to access her, support her work. A really, really good DJ. I was like, she puts on the cape, right? This is when she puts on the cape, when she becomes a DJ. But you are absolutely right, right, Julia, when you talk about that collective rhythm and that collective vision and being a systems thinker. And as you were describing that, Julia, I always think about the complexity and how arduous it is where we have a learning organization moving in that collective rhythm around the shared vision of the desired output. And when I think about that from a systems lens, a systems design, human-centric design standpoint, to be able to achieve that collective rhythm, that's the hardest. Right? Well, one of my former professors always stated that it's not so much the hardware that's difficult or complex to change, it's more of the software, i.e. mindsets, mental models, having that collective efficacy, collective work to move in the synergistic manner around the vision. So I love when you said the collective vision, adjusting to the tempo, knowing the room, all of that is so contextualized. It's contextualized perfectly when we think about how we redesign the model, or I should say modernize the model, systems design, and discipline execution in the shared context. Collective rhythm. Right. We got to,
And I think it's also like creating conditions for flow, right? Like we're not controlling every single note. We are literally, and I think about like this as a DJ too, you're creating this environment for people to connect, right? And it's an emotional connection. I could throw out all the facts and figures. And I think I read this in like Bowman and Diehl's Reframing Organizations, which is a book that I hold dear to, I think, my leadership style and how I look at systems. It's really facts and figures are not going to move things. It's when we tell the stories or when we can connect with somebody's humanity. I think that's what moves things forward. And how do we do that in a collective way? So again, conditions for flow, it's not about control, right? Like it's really just creating that space for things to happen.
Yeah, dynamic work versus control and demand. Unbelievable explanation. And you're right about that storytelling and then moving, creating those conditions. Unbelievable answer. Now, 5 years as the executive director of CETA, and to my audience, that acronym means she's the executive director for the State Education Technology Directors Association since 2021. So now under your leadership, CETA has played a pivotal role, Julia, with shaping the nation's landscape when it comes to education technology and AI. I hear you referencing the white paper that was disseminated out of CETA. I read it all the time. Use that now within my keynotes, as well as use that within my course that I created, and now hopefully moving towards this micro-credential program around the 22nd century using your work or CETA's work out of that. But also too, you developed the U.S. Department of Education's 2024 National Education Technology Plan. So not only from the CETA plan, but the U.S. Department of Education plan. But first, to my audience that might not know, what is the core work of CETA? What does that look like? And what are some of the major milestone steps that you have achieved? And then second, can you just walk us through, in kind of like the simplistic manner, the contextual threads of why the National Educational Technology Plan matters in the AC stage of education after COVID-19?
Sounds great. So yeah, I took the leadership position here right in the middle of the pandemic. Well, actually, you know, not even the first year we had gotten through, CETA's been around actually for 25 years. We're going to be celebrating our 25th anniversary later this year. And CETA has really existed to help states use technology as a lever, right, for equity, coherence, system improvement. It's not a novelty thing, right? We've been doing it for 25 years. We actually made the joke at the beginning of the pandemic. This is when I was still a state leader. We wanted to get I told you so shirts. Like we already knew that we might not have enough devices, internet connectivity, professional learning for teachers. You know, are they going to be skilled to be able to, you know, meet the demands what the pandemic basically handed to us? But the things that CETA really has done really well, one is we help states design really smart and flexible frameworks, right? If you think about folks at the state level, there's only a few of us in each of the departments of education across, or state education agency, as we call it in the federal language, across the country, right? And it was nice to actually have counterparts in other states going, oh, you're working on that too? I'm working on that. What are you learning? And how do we come together? We are a very small and mighty membership association compared to our counterparts like COSIN and ISTE. We are maybe under 500 people total. Not all of them are state agency people, but people that are maybe state-focused affiliates. And then we have corporate members that also believe in our vision and mission and everything else. So policy and governance is really a big part of what we do. We do advocacy around the things that we need, both through, you know, E-Rate for federal funding, Titles II and Title IV under the Every Student Succeeds Act, help support ed tech initiatives at state level, ultimately at the local level. And, you know, things like K-12 cybersecurity. And of course, we're talking about AI now these days and privacy and safety and all of the things. So there's definitely ways that we can be the state voice. We can provide that united voice around an issue, a particular issue that affects the ed tech space. The other thing that we do is we also look at infrastructure and capacity, right? At the end of the day, if you don't have the infrastructure, it doesn't matter if you have all the teacher training and you have devices for kids and everything else. You need safety, you know, you need the networks, you need funding, you need the stuff there in order to do the other things. So we talk a lot about data and privacy and cybersecurity and professional learning and procurement, which is the most least sexy topic out there, but it actually moves the needle because it's a process, right? It's a strategic process if you literally look at it for districts and for states. And the other thing that we do at CETA, one of the pillars is it's the human systems, right? We help our leaders be better leaders. I know that who I am today is because of my community that I've been part of for the last 23 years, helping me be a better leader. It's professional learning. It's learning how to do implementation readiness. A lot of folks that are state leaders in our space are the implementers and integrators. They might be sitting at the, you know, the leadership table at the state chiefs level. Some of them do, depending on their org chart. But a lot of us, we're more at the programmatic level, where we're then taking legislation or we're helping craft legislation at the state level and then pulling it. And then how does it get implemented in practice at the end of the day? So those are kind of the three pillars. I think I hit your question there and everything else. But under our leadership, we're considered one of, you know, a very trusted federal partner. We have been for a long time. We worked closely. We were the contractor, the lead contractor for the 2024 National EdTech Plan. That was a feather in our cap. We've been involved in every single iteration of the National EdTech Plan. This was the first time we actually got to lead the work. And one of the approaches that we took for that was, we already know what the research said and everything else. We've done lit reviews. Those, I feel like those past NETPs were very much like lit reviews. Like, this is why we should use technology. Here's all the reasons why. we really worked with the department to create more of a visionary document. Like, what do we want it to look like? We have the lit review. So that's where we came up with those three, to really talk about those three divides. And a lot of people know about EdTech about the digital access divide, right? You know, do we have enough devices and connectivity and all the infrastructure stuff? But we really looked at the design divide. Do teachers have the time and space to actually use technology in their instructional practice? So like, what does that look like? And we highlighted the universal design for learning model, which has been around for a long time, you know, 40 years, but it was actually written into the Every Student Succeeds Act. I don't think people realize that. And that's 10 years old already. And then we also have the digital design divide, which is about use, right? We want kids to be using technology in active ways, not passive ways. We don't want to see kids just using it for test prep or, you know, you have a digital worksheet versus a paper worksheet. We want kids to be using it, you know, research, communication, collaboration with their classmates, to be really using it to create and to contribute, right? Because those are the skills that they're going to need when they leave our systems. So it's really like elevating, sort of like shifting from tools to conditions for learning. That's really where we've been going lately. It's not just about the tools anymore. It's really like, how do you create the conditions for this learning to happen, this modern learning experience? And I think we're elevating, obviously, still AI, cybersecurity, because, I mean, those are the things that we talk about. But digital equity, right, from side conversations to really being more systems priority. It can't just be the ed tech people or the IT people holding that. It has to go to the front office. It has to be your state chiefs, you know, your directors of technology, your business managers. They all have to understand how it supports the sector. And that's your first question. So I'm going to stop there to see if you have any comments, and then we can talk about why the NETP matters.
So, Julia, profound. And there's a lot in there that I think that my audience could be able to unpack, be able to identify specific slithers of strategies to employ. But what was so profound of what you stated, because now I go back to my 22nd century education model, Julia, and I think about how now the 22nd century AI-centric learning ecosystem, moving from the standardized model to these learning ecosystems, part of my theory of action or value proposition, however you want to look at educational business context, what resonates is this global readiness. And you highlighted two specific sentiments: design divide and the digital design divide. Now,
it's digital design divide and the digital use divide. So there's a use divide. That's really what it is. I just tripped over my own words there before.
So now, Julia, I think about this because, like you're saying, moving from the creating the conditions of learning and this shift from intentional shift from tools to conditions of learning. When I think about now the utility, the implementation, the integration of artificial intelligence, I reference to some of our international counterparts, countries that have adopted. One country, China, has already adopted a nationwide rule that starting in kindergarten, students will receive 4 to 6 hours of AI instruction. Now, that's very abstract, right? AI instruction, 4 to 6 hours. I don't know if there are specific technicoupled protocols, policies that have been adopted universally, or is it more on the lines of giving semi-autonomy to each of the designated ministries within China to adopt 4 to 6 hours of AI instruction based off of their contextual needs and outputs? But Julia, again, just a country adopting 4 to 6 hours of AI instruction weekly versus where we're just still learning the shift from tools to creating a condition of learning. Does this, from a global competitive standpoint, not even looking at the PISA data, from a global competitive standpoint, does this put us behind in the global context?
Advantages us as a country for a couple of reasons. We have, like, right now, today, right, as we're talking, we have lots of political conversations happening, right? Screen time, cell phone bans, but then we want to be, you know, AI and work for, like, it's like, where do you figure out how to make this work at the end of the day so that kids can be safe, right? We want safety. We want to make sure that all their data isn't getting sucked up by these systems. We want to make sure that, you know, schools aren't being taken down by cybersecurity attacks. We want to make sure that, you know, but kids need the skills. And I also talk about like equity, not like socioeconomic sometimes. I'm talking about in the same building. So when we talk about the design divide, what's interesting is, you know, my kid's a junior in high school. And when she entered high school a couple of years ago, she had to take biology. Everybody had to take biology, right? It's a graduation requirement. You got to get it done. And her last name starts with F and her best friend's last name starts with M. And they're going in this two sections of biology 101 with two different teachers. And they're having varying levels of, you know, experience there. And who's getting the skills that's going to maybe put them ahead as a workforce at the end of the day? Like, there's an equity. Like, we don't have our, I don't want to use the word poop in a pile, but I'm going to use that. Like, poop in a pile in terms of what the, like, the federal government is providing guidance. We have a decimated U.S. Department of Education right now with no Office of Ed Tech leadership, which is unfortunate because when you think about the Office of Ed Tech under the prior administration, they were very future focused in terms of the NETP and AI guidance already getting put out there. They were thinking ahead, which is kind of, when you think about a federal agency, they're not usually forward there. They're kind of more reactive. And that was a nice, refreshing thing to see that they were thinking about how we can be looking at this ahead of the curve versus behind the curve. With the current administration, we have two things happening. One is we're getting rid of supports right from the federal side about what it looks like. But at the same time, you want an AI ready workforce and you want to have, you know, all of this stuff and take advantage of it. Those things are not, like, they're not meshing very well. So we're sitting in the middle here going, are we seeing another I told you so shirt moment? You know, like, is that where it's going to be? Like, what are we doing here? Are we going to be more coherent around the systems here? Right. And I feel like COVID, post-pandemic, current uncertainty in the space is really not creating new problems, right? It's revealing where we have system design flaws. Like, it's really highlighting these gaps, right? So if you think about it, and this is maybe why the NETP maybe matters in that, you know, after COVID kind of stages, we are talking about where agency matters more than screen time, right? We want to make sure that students have agency, right? That's the active versus passive use kind of space. We want kids to have, to be learners, right? Like, to have, like, and who's controlling that learning, right? It's not, the NETP wasn't about devices. It's about who's in control of the learning. So if you think about the digital design gap, right? Educator capacity is really an infrastructure thing. It used to, I think, few people would be like, oh, let teachers do what they do. It looked like when I was at school 50 years ago, et cetera, et cetera. And no, teachers also need to have, as a profession, they also need to understand how things work for them. Technology has hit the sector and we are woefully behind. And I have been on record to say, I hate the word innovation in the ed space because I don't think we're being innovative at all. I feel like we've been laughed a couple of times by other industry sectors and we're just trying to figure it out. And anytime we kind of like make an incremental jump, it looks like we're moving towards something. We look modern, but we aren't modern. So how do you become modern, right? And not just be good enough to kind of pass like a sniff test and everything else. So, but educator capacity. So I want teachers, I don't want it to be forced upon them because the teachers at the end of the day, right? They are the human in the room that can understand how to reach a student and get, you know, make the learning environment really well. But they do need to have some skills and they need to have good judgment about when to use something and when not to. And if you use frameworks that are out there that have been used for a really long time, like UDL, it's not about necessarily having every kid use technology in the same exact way. It's about creating the conditions that if you're talking about how DNA binds to itself, right? One kid might choreograph a dance to demonstrate knowledge about how that happens. Another kid might do a video and to show how it happens. But the teachers created the conditions to demonstrate knowledge, and there's a way to use technology to help get kids there, right, to do that. So I feel like for me, we overlook educator capacity. We kind of said, oh, well, XYZ. But the crazy thing about COVID, this is what I noticed, is no one missed the Bell schedule or Chem Lab during COVID, right? They missed the ritual and community. So how do we create learning spaces that still honor the ritual and community so it looks like the school that we all have gone through, right? I know what prom looked like. I know what a basketball game looked like. I know what, you know, that sort of thing. But then it may look different in terms of the learning environment. So for me, it's around coherence versus compliance. And I hope that we can figure out a way to kind of get right there.
Coherence versus compliance.
Over compliance. Compliance is one thing, but how do you do more of a coherence in this space, right? That we all are kind of moving towards the same shared kind of vision of what we want for our kids.
Yeah, coherence over compliance. I loved how you articulated that there are systems design flaws. Apps, 100% correct, because I mean, you and I can just sit down and arbitrarily identify what are some of those gaps that we see within the system and itself and the construct. Love how you focused on capacity, but again, you kept on referencing, you referenced this four different times, conditions for learning. And I think that is so vitally essential. It kind of is that throughput leading towards how we build systems around capabilities so that there won't be any flaws or gaps in it. Coherence over compliance. I'm going to steal that, Julia, because I think that's so true. But Julia, I want to stay on this topic, right? Because there are specific components from the 2025 State Ed Tech Report that I want to unpack. And what shocked me, and I heard you said this at FETC, I followed up and read the actual report itself. The report is really compelling, really it was well-written, sequenced very well. But some of the things initially shocked me. And one was that the details that AI has surpassed cybersecurity as a state priority, coupled with infrastructure investments in technology, right? So we know that information from the State EdTech report. But that same report, Julia, revealed that 27% of states have plans to sustain projects funded by pandemic era ESSER dollars. Now, first, how will education be able to sustain these radical shifts in the context of AI? And then two, districts are experiencing tight budgets. We know that. I speak to superintendents pretty much every day, and I know what they're trying to work with. How do we sustain technology and AI initiatives as priorities for strategic budgets within or strategic budgeting within learning organizations, superintendents, and board of educations?
So what's interesting about those ESSER funds, and I think people think that, you know, now that they're gone, that there's no money going to states, and that's not necessarily the case, right? There's regular funds that go to the states that go ultimately to districts every year, right? That's the Every Student Succeeds Act money. And that is something that we always advocate for, that it actually is appropriated. It's actually allocated at appropriated levels, because it's not, all of it's not. The good news is, under the current fiscal year budget that just got passed, so that things can still operate, it was mostly level funding, and Title I actually, and I think IDEA, received a slight increase. So that's good news. But the ESSER funds were one-time funds that got sent to states during the pandemic, right, to be able to meet what was going on. And what we found is last year in 2024, we asked the question, as a state, as you know that these funds are going to go away, these one-time funds, you made investments in technology, whether it's buying devices or training your teachers or whatever you decided to do underneath the rules, are you going to continue to invest as a state? The federals are going to go away. Will you as a state step up and sustain some of the initiatives? Because what that money allowed it to do, because it was a bump, allowed it to maybe dip into something that they may have not invested in before to be able to invest in it. What we found in 2025, though, is it actually dropped to 6%. So what we're seeing is states are constricted budgets as well. Everybody has like this economic uncertainty. They're dealing with all that kind of stuff. And that was not a surprise, right? The 27-6, because some of them are like, well, we might not be able to sustain it. We don't have the funds coming in, and the feds aren't obviously underpinning that anymore. What we're finding, though, with AI, especially, everybody's talking about it. It doesn't mean that cybersecurity isn't important and then some other met needs. It just kind of jumped to the number one slot. What we're trying to figure out is, it's not a program, right? We don't have an AI program. This is a general purpose capacity, right? Are we going to use it internally for operations? Are we going to use it? Are school districts going to use it for operations? Are they going to use it in the classroom? Are they going to do AI literacy? Like, how does it start to get implemented? And really, what it is, it's about, is like governance first and tool second, right? We need to create sort of the container saying, this is where you should use it. This is where you probably shouldn't use it. Like, that's guidance, right? But then go forth, right? And then you can figure out how tools support that kind of container. I had the fortunate luck, and I've been telling this story, just after when ChatGPT kind of hit the scene, I was on a flight from Seattle to DC, and there's nobody in the middle seat. So this is also like fortuitous for me, but I started talking to this guy, as you do on a plane, and it turns out he runs AI for the Department of Defense. Here I am trying to also verify that this is really legit. Like, he's not just some guy telling me this, but, you know, like looking at my Wi-Fi and seeing it, and he was legit. It was really him. And I said to him, okay, you run the Department of Defense. What advice would you give K-12? Because you have a system that's way more complicated and complex than our system, right? And there's a lot more at stake in that space than our space. And he said, you need to develop those use cases. And in essence, I think that's what we're trying to do, is figure out what the use cases are. Where are we going to use it? Where are we going to be like, no way, Jose? And even today, I think this week, there is a big push about AI generated, you know, images of, you know, minors and nudes and everything else. Like, maybe we need to get to a place at the federal level. There's a call for, like, you just can't do this. You have to, like, figure out how to stop it. And that might be a use case. Like, we don't want to do it as a country. We might come up with that, right? But what we are trying to do with AI in particular is kind of embedded into those existing workflows. And in some ways, it might even cause us to rethink the system, right? There might be a better way to do a process using AI. So treating it more as infrastructure and not as an enrichment, right? It's not an extra. It's going to be here. It's going to be part of our systems. How do we, like, you know, slot it in there and everything else? But I think for me, it's not about necessarily like funding more. It's about funding differently, right? So how do we sunset low impact tools? You know, how do we consolidate platforms? I think you were there when I told a startup community, like, don't build us another LMS. We don't have time.
End it. You said it. End it.
Just like, we don't have time for you to build another LMS. And nobody has the wherewithal to migrate to a new LMS right now.
You, Julia, I remember you said it. We were on a panel to my audience. We were on a panel at EdTech Week. There was about literally 150 people in our session at EdTech Week. And Julia so kindly stated, if you are building another LMS, stop. Do not build it. Immediately stop right where you're at. FETC, we're on another panel, highly attended. I said this before and I said it again, and I'll say it again. Stop. Do not design another LMS. I was waiting for that, Julia. Go right ahead.
But I think for me is really, I think people can figure out what the pain points are with current LMSs, right? And then help alleviate those pain points. And I know you have articulated very well in the same panels about working with us to solve problems. Don't come to us thinking that you are assuming what our problems are. Like, really sit there and listen and talk to us at the state level, at the local level. Like, what problems are you trying to solve? Tell me about what you're doing. And then you can figure out if there's an alignment between your product and what they're trying to do, right? And maybe bow out. I mean, ethically, in some ways, if your product doesn't do that, don't try to make it, you know, fit it in there. Just say, this isn't going to work out, and go find somebody else that's probably going to do that. But I think it's, for me, around funding and everything else, like, right now is like, how do we invest in people and systems and not necessarily more and more pilots of stuff? And for me, the question isn't around, can we afford AI? It's more like, can we afford not to redesign around it, right? Like, can we, that's the trade-off there and everything else. So I think we can use AI to reduce costs elsewhere, whether it's time or duplication or inefficiencies, but I don't think it's a program per se, right? Like, and that gets wonky when it's a program. It's harder to put your arms around because programs then bleed into other spaces and everything else.
And Julia, when I was superintendent of schools, I remember I was a part of the American Rescue Plan Committee. And they were reviewing data, and a lot of the districts across the country were investing in people in lieu of exactly what you were stating, to invest in systems and capacity, longstanding more than people. Obviously, we want our people. There's importance within every single stakeholder, but that one-time funding from a sustainability standpoint, systems, capacity lasts longer than people and organizations with that. Very good. And this is, I think, is going to be the problem of practice in the AC stage of education, is exactly what you were talking about, is the intentional interconnectedness of technology and AI within the operating model and how we address design, systems design, within those specific variables of the operating model: operations, curriculum and instruction, technology, facilities, right? How do we now deconstruct to reconstruct these new tenets within the operating model? And Julie, please, intellectual banter is wanted. I don't know collectively if we all necessarily know what that looked like when it comes to systems design around AI coherence within the model. Because now you're talking about, as you stated, a shift from tools where we're looking at the alignment of intelligent systems to the organizational needs, and then the coherence, vertical, horizontal alignment within the system itself. This is where now you have to, and there's no way, you have to dismantle silos, where now work becomes interdependent. Julia, this is a one-word question. How?
For me, I feel like, so from my vantage point, right, and the folks that we work with, a lot of it is guidance first, right? And I think looking at guidance, just it helps kind of define the container. And I know a lot of times when states are putting together guidance, they put together stakeholders. It's not like some random person's, you know, job in the back corner that's making guidance. They literally will engage a task force, put it together, and that sort of thing. But ultimately, especially in the AI space, I really do think that the guidance has to reduce cognitive load, not add to it, right? We don't want to add more stuff. So I feel that effective guidance really has clear values and guardrails, right? And values should, they should reflect context, right? Like context over compliance, right? One size guidance fails. And I'm sure you know this in real classrooms, it really fails, right? And a lot of this is like, you know, anchored more in lessons learned and not necessarily theory, right? Like this is, you know, we have this thing. We want it, like No Child Left Behind, great idea in theory, lessons learned. How we measured it obviously was a pain point for people, right, in the assessment space and everything else. It didn't mean that we didn't want to still try to serve all the students, right? But it was a pain point. The assessment became the thing, right, that we all focused on versus are we creating conditions for all students to be successful, which is what I think the intent behind the law was, right, was to make sure that all students were successful, not just the ones that the system fit for. I feel like there's got to be some room for agency and trust, right? We have to trust that educators need permission to experiment in some ways, not just rules. We need to help them build their judgment muscle because in AI, they're never going to learn everything. And I think that's where people get very overwhelmed. Like, I got to know everything. I'm like, no, you need to have a judgment framework. Like, is this, should I be using it here? And then you can kind of go down the rabbit hole from there, whether or not you want to be using it in your classroom. Time is very much a design restraint in our system, right? Like we don't, you know, everybody's gifted the same amount of time, you know, in the world. Everybody has the same amount of time every week to do things with. But I feel like adoption fails when we ignore sort of workload realities and we have to figure out a way to kind of work around that. I feel like it's learning with technology, not about the technology, right? It's like, it's not about the technology. We've been talking about this a lot with professional learning, right? Again, in our state trends report, we talk about professional learning always being one of those top unmet needs, not one or two, but it's always been up there. Like, how do we do it? And CETA did release a report last November around professional learning systems and how to use both the Title IIA federal dollars that states and districts get, but also other professional learning dollars to actually figure out how do we help teachers learn how to design their instruction with technology, not just learn about it. And for those folks out there, like in the ed tech developer space, you can't just come in and say, well, we're going to offer training and it's only about how to use your tool. Like, I'm going to open a file, I'm going to do X, blah, blah, blah. It has to be like, how do I use this tool in an instructional practice, especially when you're hitting the ed tech side. And then I feel like we have to sort of, as leaders, model what learning looks like. I feel like, and maybe this is where I use sort of my DJ and how I actually got on Twitch story to come into play. I started DJing on Twitch when I knew nothing. I thought I better be out there when learning is kind of messy because no one is this top DJ overnight. Like, you start from somewhere and there's time and effort and focus that's put in. And how is we as leaders do that also publicly, right? So that people can see that we are also learning as we're going. There's a transparency there because I think if we're not learning publicly, like how we're doing this, I think systems do stall on that, right? So I don't know if that kind of answers your question necessarily. I don't know if we went AI, but I went more systems again on top of the whole thing.
No, here's the thing, Julia. You went above and beyond because systems and AI are not mutually exclusive. And there has to be, you know, there's this context where we have to pay attention to the operating model and how we're designing in the context of our systems of integrating AI. When I think about, you know, we always talk about curriculum instruction and tools, and you stated it, that we have to have this shift from tools. There's a lot of tool investigation going on in our classrooms. There's a lot of utility of AI tools within instruction, but how is it influencing the level of coherence in the context of the design that addresses what you stated, that there are system design flaws, because it's usually not how you said it, coherence over compliance, is usually compliance over coherence, the traditional construct of education. As you stated, is not, you know, context over compliance, is usually compliance over context, where context has to adjust to the complacency. Hence why we see immense tensions in education. You're absolutely right. There's time is a critical design restraint, because time needs to be the essential variable for anything that we do. But Julia, I want to go on to the next question because I really want to hear your answer in this. And you were just alluding to guidance, right? And roughly and probably you can regurgitate and recite the data, the specific data regarding this. But for reading from that report, about half of the states are prepared with AI guidance within the past year. So I want you now, because you used that word guidance several times within your answer, for level setting purposes, to create that, as you would state, collective rhythm, right? Defined effective guidance in the context of an impact lineage from the state education agency to the local education agency to our schools. How can we make AI guidance focus on coherence in lieu of just checking a policy check or policy in the box, i.e. compliance that we're so used to?
So what's interesting is I think there's over like 35 states now that have issued, or a state education agency that has issued guidance. And usually that typically is more of a vision, and some really went deep and some people did a cut and paste. No lies, right? Like, and I'm not going to call out the states that just have a web page that, you know, slap some stuff up on there and everything else. Because everybody's trying. I feel like every state's trying. They're trying to get their arms around this, and they have other priorities and other things that are conflicting also with what's going on, right? There's just a lot of things happening. Again, that time. We don't have time sometimes to do this. But for us, what our group members are doing is, now that we have the guidance out there, and some have already have revised their guidance, right? They already have, you know, 18 months have gone by. They've gone, and it's a living document more so than anything else. And we have states issuing AI, state legislatures issuing guidance as well, because they're going to start putting arms around, like, we don't want it used. Again, I feel like it's the use case thing. Like, we don't want it used here. We want it used there. We want to make sure that people understand what the use cases are going to be. But ultimately, for context, right, at the local district level, a lot of the policies that we're seeing are giving the flexibility, right, to the districts, right? There also has to be some fidelity, right, at the same time. But that's where I think districts can then look at their context and figure out how it works within their local communities, right? And perhaps, you know, engage in the same sort of exercise and practice that states do, where you get stakeholders. And I hope to God that students are part of that conversation, because ultimately they're the ones that have to, they get impacted by it the most. And you might find, and I think we're seeing this in the cell phone things, students actually are liking the fact that they don't have to have their phones, you know, like the phones on, you know, on or whatever. They get, someone is kind of making a decision for them, right? The cognitive load for a kid is now off the table. But could we have students at the table? Can we have parents at the table? Can we have school leaders at the table? Can we have the, you know, the regular educator at the table too, right? Not just the one that, you know, always uses the technology and is gung-ho. Can we have the ones that maybe are trying to figure out how to adapt it, and they can ask good questions to be part of that? But that's where I think the context happens, right? And the use case, the real life use cases. And we can walk through some of that you know, what about this? What about that? What happens in this thing? So that you can think about how those decision-making frameworks happen, which then ultimately leads to better judgment, right? By the teacher. Should I be using it or not in my design of my, you know, instruction here? And that helps, right? And there's got to be some feedback loops. You know what I mean? It can't just be a one and done, like, oh, the school board signs off on it. You know, you do all this work, you send it out. Is it working? Does it need to be tweaked? You know, is there a situation that popped up that they didn't plan for? But it's really around, you know, the checkbox guidance. Like, I don't want this, you know, we don't want people to say, well, we work with districts, check, you know, we did whatever. But I think you avoid checkbox guidance, right? By measuring use. Are people actually using it? Guidance is there to be used. It's not just a shelf document and put away, or we take it out and we hit you over the head with it, right? Like saying, hey, you should have done what? It's really helping a framework. And when you hit those boundaries or those edges, does the framework actually allow you to make a decision from there? Or do you need to actually open that thing back up and say, okay, now we have this as it goes forth, right? And then how do we design for implementation, not optics, right? Not the optics. Like, I know a lot of people want to be out front and center. And I think I wrote something on this, my LinkedIn recently, because I got this end of year, you know, I was in my inbox after vacation. I was reading these end of year reflections in January. And this one person's like, well, we predicted. I'm like, the game is not to predict it or be right. The game is to like get in there with us and move us forward. That's the leadership that I don't really want to see at the end of the day. So again, it goes back to how do we create guidance or those frameworks that reduces cognitive load, right? It doesn't add to it. And I think those are the ones that those types of documents and those types of exercises and practices are the ones that will go forth and lay a foundation for us, you know, integrating it with fidelity and flexibility.
I love your answer, Julia, because A, you had me when you stated that student voice, students need to be involved in the design process. Right now in the AC stage of education, Generation Alpha, soon to be matriculating in the PK-12 continuum, Generation Beta, obviously within time, but Generation Alpha specifically need to be a part of the design. I think there's too many adults that sit around in a circle that are very smart, that are like you, Julia, that are like Rob, that are like Sophie, Saba, Jacob, where we all sit around, or where they sit around, and I'm not talking about them in particular, but the adults, and we make decisions for kids, when the kids are not, or the families are not directly involved in the design process, because again, they are the end users, the customers, as we stated, the most important customers. But Julia, this is really the first time that it was framed in such a definition that makes so much sense on the goal of reducing cognitive load, right? And, you know, in going through the feedback loops to be able to now strategically reduce cognitive load around the language of the guidelines, right? And Julia, I think you might state it even better than what I can state, is that in lieu of policies, because policies are, to me, represents the standardization of specific behaviors, values, and norms of a learning organization, guidelines have that, I like to say, exploitation, exploration, to have that level of adaptive or being adaptive within the LEA schools, even at the SEA level. One phrase that I think that really resonates with me, and I'm sure resonates with my audience, design for implementation. Wow. To my audience, there's roughly about 3 or 4 different answers. Julia, I say this every episode. We use this as an asynchronous tool for professional learning, andragogy, heterogogy at its best. And to my audience, there's about 3 or 4 answers that I would like for you to go back, right? And to take a look at and to unpack surgically and synthetically so that you can identify specific strategies within your learning organization, state education agency, coherence over compliance, context over compliance, flexibility and fidelity, design restraints because of time, design for implementation. Julia, I got my whole notebook here. I'm writing all of this down. But Julia, I love you so much. I'm only going to limit you to 3 words on this last answer. And I know I can't. I know I can't. Julia, keep to my audience, keeping Julia Fallon quiet, that never happens. So
and then get her with a golf club. That's a whole other story.
Top Golf. We had so much fun. That's a different episode, right? A different episode of Top Golf and being DJ. But Julia, what three words do you want our audience today to leave today's podcast regarding designing a technologically enabled education model in the AC stage of education?
I would say coherence, agency, and trust.
Oh, you're really going to follow the rules.
I'm really going to follow your thing.
The only reason why you're doing that is because we have an audience watching us. That's the only reason why, Julie.
I'm complying versus...
compliance. Well, instead of Louis, you being compliance, can you expand on coherence, agency, and trust?
Yes. I think for me, it's about, one is we're designing for humans, right? I think at the end of the day, the goal for us isn't, and we're going to use students as the focus right here. The goal isn't preparing students for technology, right? It's preparing systems for the humans that they're going to be as they go out. So how do we have a more coherent system that actually supports that? We've talked about workforce development and kids having skills to be successful all day long. I think we've been talking about since the 80s, right? Like, I mean, this is going on. This is work that's been going on for a long time. I know that when I joined OSPI in the early 2000s, I was in CTE. That's where I started, right? Talking about the skills that students need. Every kid, regardless of where they go post-secondary, are going to need skills, right? They're going to need skills. And for me, digital fluency is a civic fluency, right? It's being able to to participate and contribute to society as a whole. And I'm not talking about jobs of tomorrow, like robot jobs and jobs we don't know of and what they don't look like. I'm talking about everyday jobs, a farmer and a combine. I don't know how many people maybe have not been in a combine, especially city folks, but it's pretty complex in there. So complex that the systems are doing their things and then you have kids doing TikToks from the middle of there, you know what I mean? But it's really looking at the field and all that stuff. And people are farmers, people are accountants, people are nurses, we're all going to be using technology. And for me, it's, can they participate and contribute once they leave our system at the end of the day, whatever they decide to do post-secondary? Agency. I really feel that we need to have more agency-centered learning models. Again, we've been talking about this for 20 plus years, it feels like. Students need to be co-creators in learning. That's how we know what learning theory says. Why are we not designing systems that allow students to do that? And I think people have this idea like, you know, well, they need to know the 50 state capitals. Yes, they probably do, right? But they need to be, they don't need to memorize it, right? They need to figure out, how do I learn what the 50 state capitals are and how do I verify if that information is correct? Because I don't think they need to lodge it in their brain cognitively, you know, maybe the state they live in, but not all 50. Like, what is the purpose of that? Like, really looking at the things that we're teaching. Now, how cells divide pretty much hasn't changed, right? We have the science around that and everything else. The question is there different ways for students to explore that concept so that it actually constructs their own knowledge, right? And then be able to demonstrate whether or not they know that. And it could be, again, through non-tech ways. It could be through tech ways. But can a teacher design a learning space where students can then demonstrate knowledge in the way that they know how? And maybe they do that, you know, the technology can help them do that. And then trust. I feel like we need to have that as a default. You know what I mean? Ethics, safety, and trust by default. Like, that's a non-negotiable in some ways. I trust teachers. You know what I mean? Like, teachers do not, I always think like teachers aren't teachers because they just, that's the thing. And they're getting paid, you know, $500,000 a year in a tech thing. They teach because they want to teach and they find joy in that. And there's human connection in there. And can we trust them by default and not assume that they're just, now, granted, there's got to be some work about getting the folks that are not doing well out of the system. And maybe that's more feedback loops in the space and capacity. But for the most part, teachers really want to serve their students and they want the support to be able to do that well. And how do we do that? I mean, and these are big questions though, of course. So I feel like even with the three words, I mean, these are big questions and big problems that we're all trying to solve together. But I feel like we have to have some sort of trust that we are going to figure it out if we work together. Again, it goes back to your first question. You know, leadership is not something we do alone. It is something we do with others. And that's how we will get better and improve, and collectively we'll make, you know, better outcomes for the students that we ultimately serve.
Julia, well stated. Well stated, my friend. Coherence, agency, Love the extension and agency learning model that, as you stated, that goes back to learning theory 101 of truly what the design of learning should be, reduction of cognitive load for the teacher per se, right? With regards to instructional practices and shifting the locus control back to the students. Absolutely, I agree with that 1000%. Now, an agency learning model with AI. And the final word, I think we need a lot of that today, is trust. Miss Julia Ballard. Yay. Julia, if any, well, I'm going to call you and I'm going to email you. But if any of my audience want to go further with regards to many of the mega, not just meta, a lot of the mega themes that you highlighted within this podcast episode, how will they be able to get in touch with you?
Well, one is they can just go to our website, CETA.org, CETDA.org, where they can get, you know, our reports are out there for folks to use. Our state trends report is really good when you're trying to make some legislative requests, right? To show kind of like, you know, are you in alignment with what other folks are doing in the space and everything else? But I can be reached on LinkedIn, Julia Fallon as well. Feel free to reach out there. And just know that right now, I feel like I'm in a season of writing. I write all over the place, but I'm really trying to make sense of what's happening. And I think I try to put that out there too. Like recently, like I'm trying to make sense of this. So I've been posting a lot more because I'm trying to figure out, again, that coherence. I'm trying to make sense and hoping that other people are feeling the same way. And then again, modeling that public learning. I'm learning out loud too. I don't have all the answers for sure. And I'm definitely glad that I'm connected in the space that I am and working towards making this, again, a better learning experience for all students at the end of the day.
Absolutely. Julia, I can tell you this as a dear friend of mine. I am a big fan of your work. Thank you for the impact that you continue to have across this country and also the influence, right? I learned so much from you as well as the people in our little text group. But every time that you speak, Julia, I learn so much. I learn something new every single day by engaging with you. So, Julia, I'm spoiled every day by you, but thank you for spoiling my audience with regards to the work that you do and your whole intellectual property in totality.
Thank you so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Absolutely. And on that note, onward and upward, everybody. Have a great evening.